Yeah, all my career I've had to pinch myself, I think. Sometimes just literally pinch myself to say, wow, you know, playing for Wales at 19 and I'm still a student. And then getting selected for the Lions, 86 and 89. Again, pinching myself. And I suppose it feels great more when you're actually on the tours, like the Tour of Australia, and you're like, you're there with all, and you're looking around, seeing all these great players with you, and just pinch yourself thinking, wow, you know, and then you go to places and you treat it like royalty. And
just talk it, walk it. Walk is only. Don't just talk it, walk it. Don't just talk it, walk it. Walk is only. Don't just talk it, walk it. Walk is
only. John Devereaux, how you doing, man?
Very good, thanks, Ollie.
Mate, first and foremost, what a pleasure to have you on. I was thinking about this earlier. If we were in this era now and we had a dual Lion, dual international, there'd probably be a statue somewhere around the area. That's a hell of an accomplishment.
Oh, I think there's quite a few who've done it. You know, 7 Welshmen have done it, but many Englishmen and Scots have done it. But certainly it's a nice accolade to have. And some great Welshmen on that list as well.
Mate, some unbelievable players who have done it, but to be even on that list, that's an exception on its own. But I was very, like, obviously different generations, but I was just thinking, wow, it's very rare to happen now. We've had a couple of people gone from union to league, but not many. From league to union, but not many from union to league to do it. But, mate, like, I'm very honoured to have someone as yourself in the area, because you are, I know you're Pontycumber boy originally.
Yeah.
But, like, I'll put it under the catchment of this, of Bridgend.
Cheers.
There's so much talent in this area. It's unbelievable, and just you're a part of it.
It always has been, I think. Bridgend schools and district, very strong for many years, even when before my time, mainly due to the sports masters in the area. You know, there was a lot of big rugby men started by Ilted Williams and people like that, and Arthur Thomas. So, yeah, a big stronghold for Welsh rugby, to be honest. And we always used to have big battles with the Pontypridd, the Cannon Valley, and those teams as well. So which we know have been a hotbed of rugby over the years. But you still got the Cardiffs and the Swanseas of the world, which was strong. But yeah, Bridgend used to it started for me at under 12 with the Bridgend schools, and we used to win the old DC Thomas Cup every year.
DC Thomas, yeah, wow, what a cup! They say those Valley boys are built different, mind. Would you say you're from the school of hard knocks?
Possibly. you know, it was a tough place to grow up in the Valley. A great place to grow up in the Garo Valley. Dad was a miner. Most lads in the Garo, obviously, you know, dads were miners or something related to the mining. But, it was a great place to grow up. And, you know, it was a safe place to grow up as well. Yeah. And we used to be out all day playing sport, not just rugby, just doing all sports, which is
that's pretty amazing.
Which is important, I think.
Well, you look at it now, right? I know you don't see many people doing multiple sports out in the streets, boys, youngsters getting around anymore. It's not as common. But what I will say is there's not many, let's say, I've been fortunate to play in Australia as well as yourself, but it's not many Bridgend or Valley boys that go and do as much as you've achieved, as in go to countries, play, and even the mindset that you have as a player was very, you didn't care who was in front of you. And I think sometimes for the typical Welsh guy, we're very much based on, well, keep your head down, be humble, don't really show your full potential, just stay in your lane. But when I look at your resume from, you know, this is just from the start of Bridgend, you've gone from Bridgend from 86 to 89, and then you went to Widnes after that, 89 to 97, Sale Shark, Manly Seagulls, then Sale Sharks, Worcester, Bridgend RFC, Pontypool, and Maesteg. And in that period as well, playing for Wales in both codes, British Lion and a Great Britain. Mate, that's a pretty amazing achievement.
Yeah, I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head. You know, humble as well, but obviously give you 100% every time you're on the park. And I think the humble bit is maybe, you know, I've never took my selection for granted ever, even as a more experienced older player. So, yeah, just kind of give 100% every time you play. And I've been and loyalty comes in there. I suppose with me, I'm played at certain clubs, been loyal. You know, didn't want to move on to other clubs. Maybe had opportunity to. I mean, when I was in Australia, I did have a chance to go over there and stay full time, but I was still contracted to Widnes. That would have been a nice change, I suppose, living in Australia full time, as you well know. I only experienced a season over there with Manly, but yeah, I think loyalty comes in there. So, you know, I've got a lot of clubs, but I've had a long career. I retired at 40.
That's exceptional.
And, when I finished with Bridgend, when they went full time, when I came back the second time from up north, I found, you know, that was my time to sort of, well, look at life after rugby and building a career. So when they went full time, that's the only reason I left Bridgend was because they were going full time. So I went to Pontypool for a bit of a blip, really. I got injured there, didn't play that many games, and then thought I was going to retire, and then I ended up at Maesteg, which was a lovely place to sort of finish my career, playing with Alan Bateman in the centre, and Kevin Ellis was there, and the Boobier brothers. Yeah, good times up there.
Even just those players there at Maesteg, all probably more at the back end of your careers, but probably just having more fun than ever. It's quite interesting. I speak to so many people that when they get to a later end of their, like the latter end of their career, they tend to really enjoy rugby again, like they're being kids because they've got nothing to lose anymore. Did you find that?
Yeah, I think you get to a certain age where, I mean, as these days they're full-time professionals. We were semi-pro I was semi-pro in rugby league, believe it or not. Not many people understand that, you know. We trained at night and we had day jobs. Well, a lot of us had day jobs, except Paul Moriarty and Alan Tate was the groundsman at Widnes. But so, yeah, when I came back home, I was semi-pro and with Bridgend. And, yeah, when I went to Maesteg, it was more for the, as you say, I think you get to a point in your career where you accept you've had a great career and it's not for the money. It's just kind of having some fun. You know, that's the big part of rugby, I think. The biggest part you miss is the crack with the boys and the banter and the camaraderie. And that's the biggest thing that a lot of players find hard when they actually retire.
So true. We're going to talk a bit more about that later. But I actually want to take you all the way back. We were just in the car then driving up here and I said to you about Titch. And I said, playing together and this, that and the other. And you said, well, I didn't play too much. I played a bit with him. But actually, he got selected in the under-15s and you didn't. And, you know, for people out there who have come through age grades and they think you've got to play all of these junior rep teams to make it the top team, you kind of gone a different route to all of that.
Yeah, again, it's another thing that happens in a lot of people's careers. I've read other people's autobiographies and they've got similar things happen. You know, you don't get recognised at schoolboy level, but you never give up. You know, you always believe in your own ability. And I suppose under-15s was a time in my career where I got a bit frustrated, didn't lose heart, but I lost, you know, the sort of, I couldn't break into the sort of schools and I ended up playing football as well. So I ended up playing under-16s football for the Garu boys clubs and ended up getting a couple of caps playing for Wales in football. So, yeah, that happens. But, yeah, I never lost focus. I never lost my ambition to still play for Wales one day and sort of kept, you know, giving 100% every time whoever I played for. Sort of my biggest, success for me was to go to Cardiff College, South Glamorgan Institute. That's where, you know, that college put me in the right into the limelight there. You know,
just I'm glad you said that because I was going to talk on it. Even though you didn't get that opportunity at 15, you had one of the biggest opportunities of your life at 19, and getting the call up to Wales, and that was when you were at Cardiff
College. Second year in Cardiff College.
I've read a part of the book about it, but I want you to share the story on how you found out.
Well, the book actually opens with that paragraph, you know, the first chapter is how it happened. So, yeah, it was, I played really well against Cardiff in a cup match, the old Welsh Cup. It was the Schweppes Cup back in those days, and I played for Cardiff up in Cardiff College, against Cardiff. They had 10 internationals that day. Mike Teague was playing. John Scott was playing, two Englishmen, but the rest were all Welsh internationals. And, yeah, we fancied our chances up at college against Cardiff, and We outscored Cardiff 3-2, but Di Barry outside our kicked all the penalties and we lost. And but anyway, I had a very good game against Bob Ackerman, who was playing his first game for Cardiff, coming back from London Welsh. He was the then current Welsh International Centre and British Lion. And yeah, I had a good game. Headlines of the paper next day, fantastic, you know. Really great to have that, you know, have all that sort of, all these newspapers, you know, with your name spread across the back pages. So, yeah, literally a couple of months later, I wasn't, again, not thinking much about it. I was in Cardiff Castle on a field visit with some of my colleagues and a couple of lecturers, and this chap appeared from nowhere and said, "Is it John Devereux? It was a very important phone call." And I thought, oh, gosh, I put my hand up and thought, if something's gone wrong at home, some bad news. So, anyway, I went with this chap. No mobile phones in those days. Went to the office, picked the phone up, and a guy on the other end introduced himself as John Dawes, chairman of the selectors, saying that I was successful in being selected for Wales against England on the 18th of January, a couple of weeks later. So again, I totally didn't have a clue that the Welsh team was even being picked that day. So went back to tell everybody excited, all the happy news, and we went across the road and had a bit of a celebration in one of the pubs across the road from Castle.
Just a bit of a celebration.
Yeah, there's a lovely photo in the book with my great friend Hugh Bevan, who we grew up together from the Garo Valley. He was in college with me. I'm hoisted up on his shoulders. And, yeah, the numbers multiplied quite considerably.
Yeah.
We didn't have mobile phones, like I said, but we had jungle drums and they all descended from the college that afternoon, and we had a very good few drinks and some lovely photos of me, you know.
So it brings back some nostalgia when just talking about that right now and kind of pinching yourself. I think in stages of our lives, we're so forward thinking of what's next and this is happening, that we forget how lucky that happens and being 19 to play for Wales against England in particular.
Yeah, it was unreal really when you think about it. It was a complete unknown. I was a student. Mm. It doesn't happen these days, does it? So a special time. But yeah, I was strong for my age though, and Tony Gray and Derek Quinnell picked me because they knew what I could do for the side. You know, I could give them go forward and set targets, but also I had more than that in my game, and that was important as well. But yeah, I made room for others, and that was exciting, and I could set up tries. People, you know, hanging off me, two or three players would make space for others. So, yeah. And that's how it went. Yeah, and when you get your first cap, obviously you want to get your second cap and as many as you can after.
How long did it take to get the next one after that?
Straight away, yeah. We unfortunately lost to England at Twickenham in my first cap. I was one of three new caps that day. Robert Jones from Swansea and David Muddy Waters from Newport, second row. And we didn't win a lot of ball that day, unfortunately, so we lived off scraps. But we scored the only try of the match. We lost 21-18 to Rob Andrews' boot. He scored a winning drop goal in the third minute of injury time to beat us 21-18. So then, a week later, we were playing Scotland in Cardiff. Mm. So it was my home debut. And that was special because Paul Thorburn kicked that world record penalty that day, 64 metres.
That's right. I've seen that on YouTube.
My claim to fame that I told him to go for it. that was the second. We won the game. Scotland played very well that day, but we came away with the honours that day. Because when international rugby is a fine line between winning and losing. There is really little fine margins. And we just won that day. It was a home advantage. Yeah. We had Thorby's kick was just... Yeah. It took the stuff. You could see the shoulders of the Scottish players just drop seeing that going over, because they really did play well.
Yeah, I want to ask you though, obviously playing club rugby, even college or uni, however you want to call it, to go international at such a young age, like, are you playing fearless or are you worrying about everything?
No, that's it. No inhibitions, really. You're right. Fearless is the word, I think. Nothing to compare to. No worries. Just go out there and have people around you to give you the support. You know, the coaches, the captain, David Pickering, was fabulous. The players around me, Jonathan Davis, Lennon Bowen, you know, my immediate son. Robert was playing his first cap, so the two of us could, you know, give each other some, you know, support as well. And Yeah, it was fearless in a way. Yeah, it was. It kind of, we got out there and just do what you do. I mean, the reason I got in the Welsh team was what I did week in, week out. Yeah. So I just had to kind of try to replicate that. And that's what I did.
It's one thing about you, John, as well, I've noticed when you played was that handoff you had. Mm-hmm. But where I always think you're, I watched the more highlights now today in particular, but your ass and hip drive, it all generates from the ass, the gluteus maximus.
It's the first time someone said that, but yeah, I know. But when you say that, it's, I think that you're right. A lot of people sort of just stop in contact and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm a big believer in leg drive. Well, I'm strong anyway. You know, I was physically strong as a youngster, but John Lloyd harnessed my strength in school at the age of 14. Myself, Hugh Bevan, and a lad called Paul Riley, who was in the adjacent school. Paul was a great player. Sadly passed away a number of years ago, but three of us used to do weight training every dinner hour, Tuesday and Thursdays in school during the dinner hour. So John harnessed our strength because Hugh was very strong, strong as well.
I was going to say, you talk about harnessing your strength. Who harnessed some sabotage in you? Because I read a part of the book where you got took down for a curry down in Puthcall.
Yeah, that was just to introduce me to college life before I got to college, actually. It was Hugh Bevan and Garth Nicholas decided, we were both in college at the time. I had been accepted, so it was like, let's take him to down to Puthcall to have a few beers and tell him about what happens there, you know? So, we... went out for a few beers. I'd never drunk like that before, to be honest. We had a bit of a pub crawl and never experienced a curry. So, yeah, it was they stitched me up, obviously, by giving me the hottest curry I could probably have. And didn't take long to take effect, you know.
Yeah, and then I think you got lost and jumped in a random
car. Well, we were so drunk and we went down in Hugh's dad's big Granada car, Ford Granada, and... the plan was to go on a beer, have something to eat, and then get back to where the car was parked, and three of us sleep it off in the car. But fortunately, I lost them in the darkness, and I was drunk. And I ended up sleeping in an old abandoned car, which was so lucky, because otherwise I would have been in a lot of bother.
Dire straight there. Well, I won't share any more about the book, because I want people to buy the book and get it. But this is the book, John Devs. Dual international, we can go on about it maybe a bit more later, but how was that experience? Obviously, so totally different to playing a game, but I bet a lot of nostalgia coming up when you're talking about memories, you know, experiences, the people you've seen. And like you said, it's not so much actually about the games, it's actually about the training sessions, the nights out, the initiations to rugby and the brotherhood that it brings. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's your life. It's your story of... it's everything, warts and all in there, really. It's from day one and it goes right up to the day I retired. So lots of memories in a time when the game was amateur, early doors before I went league. And in comparison to today's rugby players, I suppose we had a bit more slack, as you would say, to go out and enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And just loads of characters in those days, lots of characters. Great stories. I had a bit of a reputation as being a bit of a Frank Spencer. Some others do have them. A bit clumsy, accident prone. Maybe the book could have been called something on those lines. But there's a lot of stories in there about my life. Some stories haven't made it there because you can go on and on, you know. There's one story particular that I wanted in there, just didn't make the final cut. It was that we were in college and every Wednesday night we would go around all the clubs. Play the Maesteg's, Bridgend's, Llanelli's, Swansea's, Cardiff's, every Wednesday night. We play every Whitbread Merit Table Club.
Oh, wow.
Every Wednesday night. And we'd go in a double-decker bus with the team to the game with a number of, you know, students and spectators. And one time, I think we were coming back from Maesteg this particular time, Leighton Davis, Nutty, his nickname was, from Bridgend, our coach, told the bus driver to go down a shortcut on the way back to Cardiff to college. And the driver was driving down, and he's going, oh, there's a low bridge here. No, it's fine, we've been down here before. So I was sitting on the back seat of the bus on the ground floor, literally looking down the aisle. And unbeknown to this, we were driving along, and next thing, this bus just crunched into this bridge.
Shit.
And I'm bouncing down the aisle on my arse. and you could see all bits of the bus all crash into the ground. Wow. It literally felt like the bus was being squeezed into the ground, and I was bouncing down the aisle. Or people were, you know, flying all over the shop. And Leighton Davis was obviously in a whole lot of trouble because he'd obviously told the bus driver to go around. I mean, the bus driver was in big trouble as well, because when we walked past him to get off the bus, because Leighton got us all off the bus, yeah. He just had his head in his hands, you know, and he was thinking, oh, God, I've got the sack. I'm going to have the sack. But, yeah, we quickly wow. scarpered. That was just one of the stories that sort of I remember vividly from our days in college, you know.
Good times. Sounds like you had some very, very interesting times in college. Thank God for no social media back then.
That's right, no mobile phones, no social media. I mean, that's a good thing, a very good thing in a way. But yeah, like you say, we're students as well. We were fit, and we play a great brand of rugby. Leighton Davis had been a sportsmaster in our college many, many years and seen many, many Russian internationals go through the ranks there. And gladly, I was one of the 50 plus, I think, that went through the college there.
Wow. Pretty impressive, John. Well, I will say, though, when we go back to your rugby days, obviously you did the 2 years, 86 to 89 at Bridgend RFC. With that stage then, I know you said that Bridgend wasn't professional then, was it? And then Widnes, we're professional. How did it all come about? I know it was this big era of all of these players coming over, but, you know, did you have any knowledge of league at that stage?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. As soon as you get in the Welsh team, you get contacted.
Okay. Right?
You're not supposed to talk to the scouts, the rugby league scouts from up north, but they ring you up or they tap you up somewhere. And you have a conversation, and then the conversation either leads to, do you want to meet to talk serious, or in my case, it was quite a few were, no, don't want to. Especially on the Lions Tour 89, a guy called Chris Keasley from Bradford Bulls, Bradford Northern at the time, chased me all around Australia, asking me to sign. But I said no, you know, and quite ironically, after that tour, I did sign for Widnes, and that came about through Jonathan Davis and Paul Moriarty already signed for Widnes. And Jonathan gave up the chance of going on that Lions tour because he signed, you know, 10 months earlier and with Widnes, and Paul signed 3 months later. But I went on that Lions tour, and it was the best tour I've ever been on, and I got my mojo back in rugby, because you go through stages, you know, go through phases in rugby. You can get a bit stale, or you lose your form, or whatever. And I certainly got my mojo back playing on that tour, mainly due to Ian McGeechan having faith in me, knowing what I can do, talking, playing, just telling me to play my game. And
instilling that belief back in you.
Yeah, instilling my belief. But playing with great players, that helps, obviously. And then I came back from there thinking, well, I'm looking forward to playing more rugby. And then I got that phone call from Jonathan and Paul saying, look, Widnes are coming for you. We've given you a lot of praise, and they're looking for something like you, basically some big, you know, hard-running sort of centre, you know, player who could play centre, you know, and other positions like wing, etc.
So we go back, John, just to, you know, after Ian McGeechan give you the pump-up talk, and then the boys were at Widnes, put a good word in for you, and you started to have your mojo back, as you'd say.
Yeah, that's right. And I, like I say, even though I met with Widnes, I was not really 100% going to sign for Widnes, you know. And I suppose what I didn't realise was that Dougie Lawton is a bit of a charmer. Charmer birds out of the trees. He's a good talker. He made it sound also very rosy, and then I suppose when they offered they put the money on the table as well.
Yeah.
I was actually signed for Widnes 2 days before I got married, so it was all done very quickly, within a week really.
Wow.
And like I say, 2 days before I got married, we asked them to keep it quiet before the wedding, so we could at least have the wedding without any hassle from press, etc. And And then we went on our honeymoon and come back, and I was straight into playing rugby after being on, as you would say, on your honeymoon for 14 days, not doing any training and quite a lot of drinking. So that wasn't ideal preparation for my first game with Widnes. But, popped two rib cartilages in my first game. And wow.
Who was that against?
We played Hull KR on a Friday night. So I got back from Tenerife on a Tuesday, and then that Friday I had to catch a train up to from Bridgend to Runcorn, and I was picked up by a chap called Eddie McDonald, who's Dougie Lawton's second in command, and then I was put in a hotel, and then I played on the Friday night against Hull KR with no training, a little bit of sort of pep talks and stuff, this do's and don'ts, but the real training came started the week after, I suppose, because then I was in the A team again. Even though I popped two rib cartilages, they jab you up there.
Yeah.
And you're back on the park, and I played against Halifax in another A-team game. Luckily, both games are witness, because both travelling to Halifax or Hull, dreadful venues, long way, and freezing cold in Halifax, even in the summer, which is up in the blinking top of the Pennines.
Yeah, that's right. How did you find it, John, like the difference between union to league? Obviously, coming in after 14-day honeymoon, even though the ball might be similar, the styles of training and everything is so different. How did you find it?
Yeah, no, it's totally different. I mean, the fitness level is different. It's high, lactic acid build-up. It can be described, I suppose. Obviously, ball is in play a lot more in league than union. You're involved even though you haven't got the ball, so you're still having to move up in defence and back and tackle once, twice in a row, maybe three times in a row, which is hell.
Yeah.
So it's lung busting, lactic acid build up, and it's tough. I mean, there's not many gaps, and union used to be a little bit more space, and there's no space in league unless you obviously break the first line, but then second line you get cut down usually by a fullback or a covering winger or a scrum half or something. But found it much harder, obviously, much more physical. In fact, I got to a point in 97, I did say to my wife, I don't think I can play another season of the league. My body can't take it, because I played a certain style of rugby, which was no holds barred, 100%. I could run round people, but I could run over through them as well. So it takes an effect on your body after a while. So, I was 8 seasons with Widnes, and it did take an effect on my body after that time. And I suppose something had to give. And then Rugby Union went pro, and Sale Sharks came knocking. Mm. Paul Turner, in fact, asking me to go and play there on a loan, so still being contracted to Widnes.
Yeah.
But going to Sale and then playing back-to-back season, basically.
That's crazy, that is.
It is crazy when you look at it. And certainly, I just saying about, obviously, my body not being able to cope with league, but it was a breath of fresh air, honestly. I mean, my first game for Sale, they weren't called the Sharks then.
Just Sale?
Just Sale. And we played at this little ground called
Hayward Road.
Maximum 3,000 people on a good day, really. Rammed in there with a temporary stand. And, my first game was against Oral away. And it was like a knife through butter. I was thinking, how easy is this? It was, the league had given me, obviously, lots of skills. Running angles. I mean, I used to run good angles in Union, but I was more of a complete player, I suppose. And I was enjoying it. And look, from there, I signed full time then the year after. Wow. So, Widnes hit a bit of financial problems. I didn't want to go the way it happened, but that's life. Yeah. It was my job. So I had to look after myself and what was important for my family. I had two young children and a mortgage and and unfortunately for Widnes, they got caught financially. So they couldn't afford me, and I had to move. Well, Sale Sharks came in with a big offer, and I went.
To be fair, though, the offer, I don't know if this is right, but it says, 350,000. signing after the British Lions for you? That was to rugby league. Was that with Widnes?
Yeah, that was the total of the contract, obviously, you know.
That's massive back then, John.
It's pretty good, yeah. Jonathan signed a big contract, but his was less years. Mine was that because it was more. I signed for a few more years. Yeah. Jonathan's was something like 2.5, 3 years, something like that. And then he signed another big deal after that at Widnes. But again, it was coinciding with some financial problems, and even though they signed Jonathan on this big contract, they couldn't really afford it.
Yeah.
And he walked out the door on a free to Warrington, or, you know, the arch enemy, really.
Yeah.
And really did some fantastic things for Warrington there. Nearly winning the league in his first year or second year. And then he ended up going back to Cardiff from there. But yeah, it was a big deal. I mean, it doesn't last long. Do you know what I mean? And always my career, I've always worried, you know, you do worry sometimes about an injury. So,
of course,
your next game could be our game. And so we did work up there as well. We all worked. Jonathan worked, I worked, most of the Widnes team had day jobs and we trained at night.
But the locals around there, they love you. If you're a rugby league player, they absolutely love you up there, don't they?
Yeah, they're very similar to Welsh. They love their sport. They're passionate about their own teams. Big rivalry between us and Warrington. Big rivalry between Wigan and Widnes as well, and St. Helens. And they're all very close together. And it's, like I say, I look back at it, and it was a fabulous time in my career. It was a new challenge, and got to travel to different parts of the world playing rugby league as well as, you know, the places I was lucky enough to travel play in rugby union.
What about, you know, getting called up then from that to playing for Great Britain as well in rugby league? Is this like, what the heck? How is this all happening? Or
yeah, all my career I've had to pinch myself, I think. Sometimes just literally pinch myself to say, wow, you know, playing for Wales at 19, I'm still a student. And then getting selected for the Lions, 86 and 89, again pinching myself, and I suppose it feels great more when you're actually on the tours, like the tour of Australia, and you're there with all, and you're looking around seeing all these great players with you, and you just pinch yourself thinking, wow, you know. And then you go to places and you treat it like royalty, and it beats working. Do you know what I'm saying? It was amateur then. It was truly amateur then. Nobody was getting paid, but it's just a privilege to be part of it. And then, it was, obviously when you become a professional, then that is your day job.
Yeah.
And your mentality changes. That's what I noticed so much about the rugby league players.
Different.
It's all about winning. Yeah. There's, you know, £50 you get for losing, taxed.
Yeah.
£250 win bonus. So yeah, and that's taxed, you know. Incentives. So we didn't lose very many games.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, we'd beat all the best sides, like the Wiggins and the Saints and all those, and Leeds and what, yeah. And then we go and lose to like a lower level side, you know, and crazy. We lose Challenge Cup games against Oldham at home, which was like mad. Because the big prize is getting to Wembley.
Yeah, of course.
And that's where the money is.
You won the Lancashire Cup as well, mate.
Yeah, we won the Prem 3 years in a row. We won the Lancashire Cup. We won the Regal Trophy. But our big goal was, it was all built, Dougie Lawton built that side to get to Wembley every year. Just like Wigan got there every year.
Yeah.
9 years in a row, actually, Wigan got there. We should have been playing Wigan every year, or if we had met each other, obviously, it wouldn't be. But yeah, the big master plan from Dougie, he promised the board that he'd get us to Wembley more often than not. And in my first year, again, we lost to Oldham at home, which is crazy. Second division side, we played dreadful. Second year, we drew Saints at home in the first round. We lost. Third year, we got there.
Mm.
But Dougie had gone by then because he'd failed to get them to Wembley. I mean, before I got there, they were playing Saints in the semi-final at Anfield, right?
Mm.
I'm a massive Liverpool fan, and I never got to play at Anfield. That's one of my biggest regrets, playing rugby league, because I used to play a lot Old Trafford. I played Old Trafford about 4 or 5 times. But we were playing St. Helens before I got to Widnes at Anfield. And a guy called Rick Thackeray, who was a winger from St. Helens, he was in the clear, and it was like a sniper shot him, and he fell over, and someone tackled him and snuffed it. It was a try under the sticks. Yeah. He was in the clear, but he fell over. He like kicked himself when he was running, and he fell over. And if he had scored, Widnes would have won the match and gone to Wembley. But
wow.
It was a semi-final of the Challenge Cup. So it was kind of like as if we were cursed a little bit, or Dougie was cursed.
Yeah.
Because he'd been there many times as a player.
Yeah. It's it's interesting because last year I was injured, but we played against Widnes at home and they weren't doing too well. And John Keogh was a coach. And those fans don't mix those words when they're not winning. They give it to their players and their coaches' staff.
They want to see effort, you know. And yeah. I think there's some players, they always pick on one more than another one. Widnes are a bit like that as a crowd. They tend to maybe pick on the odd player and keep on, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you find that pressure? Because obviously you guys were on a bigger deal, yeah, a good
definitely.
Contract.
Is it yeah, I think.
High expectation.
If you don't go there and perform, if you don't go there and show the effort, they'll single you out and tell them, you know, they're paying money, it's hard earned money to come and watch you playing. It was a shit all of a ground. I mean, it was horrible ground. What they got now is fabulous.
Yeah, the 4G.
We always wanted a pitch, like a stadium like that. It was crying out for it. Like Widnes are not a Wigan or a St. Helens with board of directors, all millionaires. Widnes had pub owners, a demolition contractor, insurance salesman. You know, they were all, there's no millionaire, well, the odd one. There was a guy called Sammy Evans. He was probably the only millionaire in there.
You know, when now you talk about it, and we'll move on to the league soon, but I want to just touch on, who was someone who impacted you the most in the rugby league area? Maybe when you were up there. I know you had Jiffy and Moriarty there, but I mean, I suppose the Welsh boys always tend to look out for each other, but was there someone up there who took you under their wing?
Oh, just lucky to have the boys there, you know. It was a little community we had, obviously myself, Paul, and the wives, you know, Paul and Jonathan in Widnes, and then we had Alan Tate was there. Mossy Coloto, another ex-rugby union convert from New Zealand. And we all became very good friends. I mean, all the wives of all the players, we used to go out for nights and everyone got on. There was a great team spirit there. We had great coaches. It was just...
good times.
Successful sides are happy sides, aren't they?
Yeah.
And we were generally successful, but like I said, we didn't get to Wembley as much as we should have. And then with the re-emergence of the Welsh Rugby League side in 91, and that was with Clive Griffiths taking the helm there, and Jim Mills as team manager, that was great for us.
Yeah.
To be able to come back to Wales, because we'd given up that hope or that dream of carrying on playing for Wales. When we went to Rugby League, we gave all that up. So to come back and to have our old fans come and watching us in, you know, big crowds in the... Fill in the vet show, 10,000, you know, I don't think it held anymore. Queues down the road at half a mile trying to get in to watch us playing. And yeah, so that was special. And you're in the anthem played again and all the other songs. And it lifted us, you know. We played some fabulous matches. I think we lost a couple of games. We lost narrowly to New Zealand down the vet. We should have won. I scored a try. And Adrian Adley pushed his chap as I was scoring a try and caught a bomb and jumped over under the sticks to win the match. And Adrian Adley had just nudged this guy close to where I was catching the ball, and the ref sort of saw it and
obstruction.
Done us, and we lost the game. And we should have won that. We lost to England narrowly in our first sort of game against England, but then, you know, we beat them the next time, and we would beat France regular. And yeah, it was great. Nice. Really good too. And all the games were played in Wales, obviously.
Amazing.
Either between the Vetch or the old Indian Park.
Indian Park. Was it a time, I want to make sure it was you, but was it you who broke your jaw against Australia?
Yeah.
That was a nasty one.
Yeah, it was a number of circumstances which caused that. I'd been out with a bad injury to my back for a long time, 6 months or more. And I'd come back, I think I'd had maybe one game prior to that match, and Clive Rowlands picked me to play against the Aussies in the first game of their tour.
That's right.
Down in Indian Park in 93. And I was playing right centre that day, and Alan Bateman was playing left centre. And Alan pulled out just before the match, something, a back spasm or a twinge something in a warm-up or training. Anyway, they picked Scott Gibbs to replace him off the bench. And Scott wanted to play right centre and not left centre. And so I decided, okay, I'll switch. No, it's just one of those things. I was marking a guy called Mal Meninga, the Australian captain, just man mountain of a chap.
What a legend of a bloke.
20, you know, he's about 20 stone, huge guy.
Yeah.
Been around a while, you know, he was on that sort of downward, you know, slide from the best of his years, I suppose. But he was still a hell of a player, captain of his country. Yeah. And I just went in and tried to smash him, I suppose, and put my head on the wrong side, being that I'd come from the right side and predominantly I'd played most of my rugby left on the right, and I put my head on the wrong side in the tackle, you know. My timing was out, caught a shoulder, and yeah, he smashed my jaw in four pieces, yeah.
I remember that. I'd seen the video of you coming off.
It was the most horrific injury I've ever had, you know, from pain and discomfort, obviously. But yeah, it's not advisable to break your jaw playing rugby, but...
What a player he is, though. When you just say Mal Meninga, I think he's an immortal as well.
Yeah,
he is. So.
Yeah, he's been made one of the immortals. There's not many of them.
Well, it's eight, I think.
Yeah.
But, man...
And we had crossed paths that summer in Australia. I was playing for Manly. He was playing for Canberra Raiders. We played at Brookvale Oval, and he used to wear this huge arm guard on his arm to protect his arm from, I guess, he may have broke his arm. Mm. Or just to smash people. And he lifted me off the floor because I was quite an upright tackler in those days. I used to sort of smother people, and he just caught me right under the chin and lifted me off the floor and threw me backwards like a, you know, and it looked dreadful, but he wasn't that bad. But anyway, I was hounded by the press after the match because he wasn't binned or nothing. Wow. And then he got cited for two matches, so he probably thought, you know, I was having to do with that. But... he probably just gritted his teeth a little bit more when he put his shoulder into my jaw. Mm.
Well, like you said, for people who don't know him, he's an absolute legend. And that Australian team alone is full of stars.
Yeah.
And you guys give him hell of a game anyway.
Yeah, it was a horrible day. It rained terribly, which didn't suit our game. And they're the world champions. Fantastic team. Played against them... lucky to play against them three times in league, you know, once for Great Britain and twice for Wales, and won one. But we were nearly, we were actually beating them in 2000 when myself and Paul Moriarty went back to rugby league to help Clive Griffiths out, because me and Paul had gone back to Union, and Clive had some injury problems, and he called myself and Paul up to see if we could help out with the injury problem. So our rugby union sides, Bridgend and Swansea, respectively, let us go up. So that was a great experience. We drew the Aussies at McAlpine Stadium, Huddersfield, in the semi-final of the World Cup. Nobody gave us a hope, obviously, but we were winning with 58 minutes gone. And then they just grabbed the ball off us and squeezed us and came out in the end winners. But it was a... would probably be in the biggest shock in history of any sport, I think.
It would be. Mate, from that then, your league days, and you come back now, it seems like you're doing a slow trip down the south. You're slowly from Sale to Worcester and slowly coming down. Was that always the plan, or was it just packed?
No. I wanted to stay at Sale Sharks. They were a guy called John Mitchell, the Kiwi number eight, was building a great squad there, and... big ambitions, and Sale had ambitions, and after my time there, they eventually got there. You know, they won the premiership, but at the time he was building a side, and I was part of it. And then I unfortunately broke my ankle. It wasn't a bad fracture, but it was an awkward one. It took a little longer than you would expect to heal, and in fact, I was out a year.
Yeah,
so that's a long time, and then you sort of start to worry then that what are they going to think, and that's what happened. So I found it very hard to get back into the team, and I decided just to go to Worcester on loan, just to get some rugby under my belt. And there was through a, you know, up and coming side, winning, which helps. And a guy called Cecil Duckworth, who was the chap who invented the Worcester boiler, he was pumping loads of money in there, and he was assembling a big squad there. And yeah, it was good times. But unfortunately, that all went a little bit pear shaped right at the end of that season. And when I first joined them, we were winning every game. But unfortunately. I was just there on loan, and it served its purpose, you know.
Yeah. Did you find that you, like you said, when you went to Sale, you found your mojo again? Not mojo again. Sorry. You just felt like you were knife through butter when it comes back to Union. Was that the same concept then after the ankle injury, or did it take a long time to build?
Oh, I mean, it takes a toll on you. You know, I had aspirations. I remember playing for Sale Sharks at Saracens Ground, where they were playing at Vicarage Road then. Home of Watford, and Graham Henry came to watch us play.
Wow.
And we had signed Shane Howarth, Simon Mannix, a number of other internationals, a couple of Irish boys, and we were playing Saris, and I was marking Seller, and Liner were playing, Philippe Seller, Francois Pino, they had some aside, and Graham Henry came to watch the match. After the match, we were travelling home on the bus, and Shane Howarth's mobile phone rang on the back of the bus, and he's talking, and he's going, Graham Henry's on the phone, and he said, oh, well played today to Shane, and tell John Devereux he was impressed, you know, thought he played well as well, you know, so that was great. And anyway, and just at the end of the conversation, he said to Shane, he said, find some Welsh grandparents, you know, so... We all know the story after that, don't we?
We all know the story from there.
But unfortunately, I broke my ankle a couple of games later.
Shit.
And, I was out for a year. So it really hit me, because that was 97 and I wanted, you know, I was looking to break back into the Welsh setup. You know, I was still young enough.
How old were you at that stage?
I was 31, I think.
31, okay. Yeah. What do you, like, obviously then after the Worcester, you went back to Bridgend, then Pontypool and Maesteg. Yeah, was that like a bit of a homecoming there?
Yeah, it was kind of like, we were very happy living up north. My wife was very happy. The kids were happy. And I think an opportunity arose that, you know, it wasn't going to, Sale Sharks was not going to happen anymore. Mm. And then I got a call out of the blue from a chap called Leighton Samuel, who had just taken over Bridgend.
Wow.
The money was nowhere near what I was, nowhere near what I was on at Sale Sharks. But then I had an offer of a job and a career, I suppose, after rugby.
Yeah.
And I just put the two together and I thought, right, that's a bit better.
Yeah.
Still nowhere near what I was on at Sale Sharks.
But it was what's going to happen after rugby.
It kind of got me thinking about coming back to living in Wales and then building a career off the field. And that's what happened.
That's nice. I like that a lot. And it's good that, you know, that not many people are lucky enough to have that opportunity to transition at some stage. And I don't want to delve in it, like, you know, I don't want to delve into the negatives, but, you know, you get to a stage in your career, John, where up here, you've got it.
Yeah, yeah.
But your body is not just responding the way it used to.
Yeah, well.
And it's a kind of the, you know, the change of the torch, or, you know, the torch passing it on to the next gen.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? Or how did you deal with that?
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because, like you say, your mind thinks you're like a 21-year-old, but your body just moves a little bit slower. And I guess with me, because I ended up getting to 40 years of age, I was moving slower. But then you're a bit wiser, and you see the game a bit differently. And I realized I couldn't do. Score tries like I used to be able to score or whatever, but I still knock holes in people.
Yeah.
So I got more of a kick out of setting up tries for people then rather than scoring them, little things like that, you know. And obviously bringing the youngsters on and giving them advice and stuff like that. But yeah, they still enjoyed playing, but like I say, couldn't score those like 60-metre tries. Yeah. But funny actually, you know, the 3 years... After, at the end of my career at Maesteg were great times, and, you know, Leighton O'Connor and Gareth Brown were coaching up there, and we had great team morale up there. It was one of the best actually team morales I'd ever experienced in the game. And we were, yeah, we were punching above our weight. We were in the second division or the championship, not the premiership. And we drew Newport in the cup. And I was 40, just turned 40. And we drew Newport in the cup. And we beat them up in my stag there, the old parish, in the cup match, quarterfinal of the cup, and Conicum and Alta Cup. And I had man of the match. I scored two tries, man of the match. And I suppose that would have been my swan song, you know, that would have been a nice way to bow out. But unfortunately for me, my next game was Ebervale on the Wednesday night, and we lost. And my knee just sort of exploded, and I just went, and old age caught up on me, and I had to retire. And
I 40's a, 40 that back then, even 40 now, that's rare. To be doing that back then, John, is exceptional.
Especially with all the injuries I've had, and I've had a couple of injuries. A lot of them have been on the field, and a lot of them have been off the field, like stupid things like car crashes.
Oh, wow.
Running through glass doors on holiday with Paul Moriarty and the wives. Yeah, some involved other glass and other injuries. Yeah, all of them seem to cost me time on the rugby pitch, you know.
Is it any... Like when you talk about, you know, not foolish stuff essentially, John, but more, you know, like you said, things off the field have cost you. Is there any ones you look back and regret on? Like, oh, I wish it wasn't, you know, normally nothing good happens after 2 a.m., they say. Is there anything like that with you, John?
No, not really. I mean, we all enjoy a drink and, yeah, and so... Certainly up in rugby league, and we never touched a drop of alcohol in the week. And our night was, most of the time we played matches on Sundays in rugby league. So our night was Sunday night. But you got to let your hair down.
Yeah.
I know in the modern game now there's very little drinking because of the demands on the players.
Yeah.
You know, you can't physically play the way that these boys are playing now in the intensity levels. And be able to go out and sort of and drink like you do, and also recover from injuries. Because, you know, we could look back in our career, I suppose, one time with Wales Rugby League, and Clive Griffiths always talks about this, you know, missed opportunity maybe when we beat Samoa down the Vetch, which is a hell of a game, and one of the most fierce matches of rugby I've ever played in my life. And we beat the Samoans down the Vetch, and I think we had something like a 5-day turnaround, but we spent a day and a half, you know, celebrating.
Yeah.
And we should have probably just laid off it
until
after that semi-final against England at Old Trafford. But, you know, there's a lot of other things carry you through matches like that, adrenaline and guts and determination. But I suppose when you're trying to recover from injuries, alcohol's not the best thing to be sort of taking.
It is, but it's at the same time though, it's so normalized in sports, and it actually brings teams together. Like, you know, after a game, you work hard together, you drink hard together, you know, you celebrate together. And I want to actually ask you about that. Is there any initiations you've had at clubs that you remember very well? Like, I remember when I played for Bridgend Athletic as a youth player, we had to strip down to our boxers and be necking drinks along the pool table. And even last year, Swindon, we had a dice roll. So if you roll the wrong kit, you have to strip down bollock naked in the team meeting, and everyone's sitting there, and for 45 minutes you're sitting there just hoping that the hot air would kick on.
No, I think, I don't know what it is really. I've been lucky with, I should call it lucky, and I haven't had to do any initiation. I think because I was introduced to Bridgend at such a young age, I was like 17, I think, my first day of a game, and they never really done an initiation then, and I kind of like, because I never had one then, and then I was being associated with a club there on from there, I never had any initiations. And so I think it's kind of an old-fashioned thing, tends to be anyway. I don't see it as much in the modern game, in league or union really, but Midness never had any initiation, but and neither did I experience anything at Sale or anything like that, but... I've seen some.
Yeah.
I've seen some of the things.
What about Kangaroo Court? They're pretty big with the Lions.
Yeah, they're pretty big. I mean, you have a Kangaroo Court on every Lions tour.
Yeah.
We had one, actually, a funny one in... I've been playing for Bridgend, so second time back in Bridgend, back from up north, and we were playing Bayrits out in out there in the European Conference or Challenge Cup, I think it was then. And Bayrits were the new side in that league. They were flying high in the league. They had Fran O'Bortica playing for them. Serge Betson was the new kid on the block, playing outstanding. Anyway, they were great side, beat us over there, but we had a kangaroo court the next day. Paul Williams was outside half for Bridgend. He was the judge, and he had Kerry Jones as one of his enforcers. And I was in the dock for my quiff, because I used to have this quiff with gel and stuff. And then they had JBR Williams in the dock for his legendary status. So, because Bayrits, the president of Bayrits was Serge Blanco. And we had our president, JBR, with us. And the judge and the jury decided to take JBR's legendary status off him in the kangaroo court. Well, he was distraught, let me tell you. He was distraught. He took it quite serious, and he was distraught at the end, because we decided that Serge Blanco was a better fullback than JBR. He wasn't very happy. But
mate. Well, that's a good one. He's an absolute legend of a bloke. God bless him now. Yeah. But just you reeling off these names, man. I remember just being, seeing them on TV or heard about them.
Well, the same, you say that. And then, we've just lost obviously lost JBR, who was a legend and somebody I'd watched and admired many times playing for Wales as a kid. But then you had Barry John, who was my first idol.
Wow. That's right.
Yeah.
I want to ask that, just naming some names right now, and I'm just thinking, wow. But I want to ask you this question, and I wonder if every athlete thinks like this, but you've achieved so much, and I'm sitting here going, wow, I wish I could have achieved half of what you've achieved, John. Do you think in your head I could have achieved more?
Definitely, yeah.
It's interesting, like these high achievers and these high performance people,
yeah.
They're always thinking, because I'm thinking, I could just lace some of your boots would be an exception, but you're thinking,
No.
Someone ahead of you that you wish.
No, we've lost cups, I've lost a World Cup final. Playing for Great Britain against Australia. I missed a tackle on Steve Renoff. Unfortunately. Cost us a lot of money. Well, cost every player big win bonus that day. But I've lost cups. I've lost Premiership Cups, Wembley's against Wigan. Unfortunately, I suppose you measure it on the disappointments of things like that, really, and could have been. But I also think my career could have been better, because I should have had more Lions Cups, Rugby Union Lions Cups, and more Great Britain Lions Cups. So
why do you think that?
Because I got injured in the first game, the week before the first test match in Sydney in '89 with the Lions. All the press were talking about who's going to play with John Devereux in the centre in the first test match, and I turned over on my ankle and against New South Wales in the week before the first test match. So I was out, and then I missed the second. They changed the team. We won. Managed to get back on the bench for the third test. So I should really have been involved on that tour. And then I went north, and then in my first season, I went on tour with GB to Papua New Guinea and New Zealand as an injury replacement, actually.
That's
in the first week of the tour, Anthony Sullivan pulled a hamstring. So I was in my first season, just finished it. Phone call, your late injury replacement for Anthony Sullivan. And poof, there I am now, flying over to Papua New Guinea on my own to join the squad. So that was my first tour with GB and first involvement, caps. And it was great for me to see how it happened and what I needed to do to break into that side. So when I first broke into the side, it was great. Got my first cap, and subsequently a number of others. But 2 years later, they went on tour again, and I should have been the number one winger on the team sheet. But things just didn't work out for me in matches prior to the test matches. I didn't play very well, made a couple of mistakes, and in league it's quite brutal like that.
Yeah.
They don't, so in reunion, if they know that you're sort of you know, number one, say, he'll still pick you maybe, you know.
You've earned in the league, stripes.
It's kind of like, well, you didn't play very well that day. You're sort of out, you know, not even on the bench. So, yeah, I should have played more times for Great Britain. I mean, I got 8 caps. I probably should have had. And then the injury stepped in, didn't they? You know, I broke my jaw against Australia. Could have played in that game that Jonathan played in, the famous try against the Aussies. At Wembley. And but I think my best time with Great Britain was when I played against in 1994 against the Kiwis. And I featured quite heavily. So the three test series. And we won the 3 tests and started at Wembley, scored a try.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And I was man of the match then at Central Park against the Kiwis. I was untouchable that day. I was on, I wasn't on something because obviously no drugs in sport.
But what do you...
I've never taken anything like that in my life. And but I was just so untouchable that day.
Okay, now you say that, and I want... This is for the listeners out there. You're talking about being untouchable. What's going through your mind to become untouchable?
Just a belief, I suppose, and just you have a feeling on a day. You know, sometimes you get on the park and you just you literally feel invincible. Yeah, it's a culmination of a number of things. Obviously, I was very fit. I was very confident. I'd been playing well for club, but I'd also just come back from Australia and I was playing well there. So yeah, it was a special time for me. And it was like my time in you know, to then go back to the coaches and say, right,
yeah,
you know, I've finally done it type of thing, you know.
What brought the best out of you as a player? Because I know some people need that tough love, some people need that arm over the shoulder. What got the best out of John Devereux?
I think everyone needs a little bit of arm around the shoulder. I think there's some players who need it more than others. A lot of players don't like screaming and shouting at you. I certainly don't like, I don't think the technique of sort of pointing out your weaknesses before a match
doesn't work. Don't
do that type thing. That doesn't work. I mean, and unfortunately, that did happen in Great Britain Rugby League, and it didn't work on me. And maybe
who was
that
the coach then?
It was Phil Larder, who was a great coach. He coached me at Widnes for a season, and we got to Wembley as a result of that. And Mal Riley, between the both of them, they would sort of just, we'd get off the bus and, but a mile from the ground, we get off the bus and just walk, and then they just literally walk with individuals and as you're walking and just pull you to one side and, you know, point out don't make this mistake, you know, today type thing. And it's like, Jesus, you know. But no, there's also experience which you could sort of, if you were in that team a bit more, you could have used that experience and say, well, you know, just cut that out or don't need to hear that. You know, you're better than that and you don't have to worry about that. But if you're trying to break into the side, it mentally is playing on your mind.
Definitely. It's interesting you say that. And, you know, you get to that certain stage as well where you find your voice in a team where you're not a youngster anymore, you're a leader.
Exactly.
And that's where you can maybe tell them, but you say, hey.
No, you're right there.
It's like, I don't need to hear that right now.
That's right. I mean, as a youngster, I used to sit in the Bridgend change room and just look around the change room and listen to all the great players there talking, and you don't talk. Mm. Don't. But then there's a time when you're in that change room and you're the person that I as a boy who sat over there now wants to hear you talking, you know.
Yeah, mate, it's just hearing you talk and the memories and everything you've done is pretty exceptional, John. Like, I love hearing all of these stories. I want to ask you a couple more before we wrap it up. Where Wales are right now, rugby union, we're in a funny position where we're in a growth stage, we'll say, you know, and you said before the show the belief is not there just yet. What do you think, from a fellow who's seen so much, played so much, experienced the highs and lows of sports, how do you get that belief?
Experience and, you know, seeing it for yourself out there, experiencing, you know, defeat. I remember 2003, I went up to Scotland with a gang of boys to play golf and then a couple of games of golf and to watch the game. And we lost to Scotland that day, and I was remember in the hotel, the Sherborne, is it, or the Sheraton, I think, the Welsh team hotel, and we were in the after the match. And I was talking to Gregor Townsend, who was still playing, and he said to me, "Devs, that team today It's a young side. He said, if that side sticks together, you'll have one hell of a side in Wales. Mm. 2 years later, Grand Slam.
Grand Slam.
So it's little things. It's experiencing loss, defeat.
Yeah.
But as a team, you build from it and you say, right. And I just remember playing against France. Everyone used to like think France were the best team that we ever played, and apart from the All Blacks, yeah? And I go over to Paris and I think to myself, this wasn't that bad. You know, I wouldn't hate coming back here and playing against them, even though they were hell of a side in Paris when the sun comes out. Unfortunately, I didn't have that same feeling about the All Blacks, which I played against three times and three times they were taught a lesson in rugby and pace, strength, power.
They're never different level.
Yeah, I mean, we were totally second best when we came against sides like that. But yeah, France and you just got experience. You sort of and you grow when you get that confidence and you get that belief, and you become better players from it.
Yeah. What are your thoughts? Obviously, like when I look at the team right now, I see people like Josh Adams, George North. I'd say they're more the experienced boys in the team now. Do you expect more out of them now as they get older, or do you think they're the old, obviously the older heads, John?
Yeah, they are, but are they carrying injuries? Mm. I know it's like the carrying injury playing. You get found out playing international rugby. Mm. It's all about fine. I talked about earlier fine margins, fine line between winning at international level these days. It can be simplest one error or just not have, you know. And really, if you are carrying injury, you're not playing the top of your game.
No.
It affects you mentally as well. And I've been there. I know you can't do it like you used to do it. I mean, Josh Adams looks like he's got a bit of a, you know, knees heavily strapped up. He's not the same player as he was. Neither is George. But, you know, their experience will make up for a lot as well. But, and there's a lot of youngsters around them. And as you mentioned, we are in transition and we've lost a hell of a lot of players in key positions.
Yes.
And we don't seem to be producing enough of that type of player. So until some of these youngsters come through, and some of the youngsters we haven't even seen yet, you know, we are literally at that stage where we don't have a lot of players to pick from.
Yeah.
Because we only got four regions, but not every region has, you know, four outside arse that we can pick up from, or four full-backs.
Very true.
You know, we're struggling in those positions and centre, certainly.
Yeah. I like that. To be fair, I know he played against England. I know he's had some flack for it, but I like that Yohan Lloyd. I know he... Is it Yohan?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I like him. Maybe not in the 10 jersey, maybe as a 15, or he just brings something that not many people can have. I know against England, when a team wins, the 10 normally gets praised. When they lose, he's the first one to get shot down. And I like someone who can play eyes up rugby. And I know in international level, you need that structure, but you do need something that can...
We've been so blessed with kicking outs and a lot of kicking outs and halves, good distributors, kickers. But you know, with these you know, the two new boys there now, Costello and Lloyd, they're not big kickers of the ball, or their kicking accuracy needs to improve. But you know, there's other skills they've got that maybe the Dan Biggers and the Stephen Jones of the world haven't got, and they need to work on those strengths.
Mm.
Because that's what defines them as a player. And who knows, they could bring something new to the game that we haven't seen for a while. But ultimately, it's your forwards. You know, if we the Irish team at the moment, I feel, are unstoppable. They've kicked on after losing Sexton. I thought they might stutter a little bit, not having Sexton to steer them.
But not at all.
They've got everything offensively. They're sound defensively, unbreakable, and they play a different intensity than any side. And they should have won the World Cup. They were my side to win it, and I just feel that they there's a little bit of bad luck, I suppose. But they blew it, I think, in that World Cup.
Next question is, what is your proudest moment?
Well, playing for Wales, of course, number one. Yeah, grow up, every boy in Wales wants to play for Wales.
Particular game?
Well, my first cap, obviously, you know, even though we lost to England, it was a proud moment. And then I suppose, yeah, playing in a World Cup. I always said at the time, so proud to be able to play in the World Cup. And there were so many great players prior to who wore the Welsh jersey who never played in the World Cup and would love to have played in the World Cup. And we played the first one.
Yeah.
And I think to finish third, you know, the way we did, I mean, getting to put some sort of respect back in the badge after getting battered by the New Zealanders, and then we beat the Aussies in our third and fourth playoff to finish third, which is still the best that Wales have finished to this day. So it's that was a special day.
Yeah.
I was still only young, 21 years of age. Mm. Yeah, and I guess, you know, those are the highlights, I suppose, of my Welsh career. It was a short career, really, before I went league.
Mm.
But yeah, going on the Lions tour was without doubt the next best.
Love that.
And you don't get anything like that in rugby league. You don't get tours like that in rugby league. And that is the special, the pinnacle, really, is a Lions tour. And you can't go anywhere better in Australia. And I thoroughly enjoyed the tour, apart from getting the injury.
Mm.
But I fought back into the team. And funny enough, we played two matches after the third test match. I think it was two matches. We played New South Wales Country, famous for the up the jumper. We played in Newcastle. And then we played the Anzacs in Ballymore.
Yeah.
And that was my last ever game of rugby union before, well, obviously, then I went to rugby league.
Wow. There's some amazing, when you're talking about some stuff, there's some amazing opportunities and just playing against these teams. My last question before the final one is, how is life after rugby, you know, how, like the highs and the camaraderie you get from sports, now, you know, long time retired, how is life after sports?
Well, it was okay for me because I had a distraction all of my career, even in rugby league as a pro, semi-pro. I had distraction. I worked.
Nice.
I kept my hand in. I always remember thinking to myself, you know, you're a long time retired, but you're also one injury away from the scrap heap, and it's important to forge a career and keep your hand in and doing something else. And so I kept my kept my mind off totally thinking of rugby all the time. So
Do you think your auntie, who didn't get the chance to watch your first game, do you think she'd be proud of your career?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, she was mad. I mean, she was mad on rugby, absolutely mad on rugby. And so was my dad. You know, my dad would take me to games as well. Well, we'd watch it first and then got into it as a eight-year-old. And then he started watching Bridgend. Then we got season tickets and to stand on the halfway line between the dugouts, and that was our spot. And what a fantastic side that Bridgend had then in the late 70s, early 80s.
Nice. And finally, man, what are you grateful for?
Just being able to play rugby, I suppose, being fit and healthy, and rugby giving me a great life, you know, and my family have, you know, benefited from my career and life after rugby.
Love that. So where can we find this book, John?
It's available at St. David's Press. You'll get a signed copy if you order through St. David's Press or through Amazon.
Awesome. Devs, what a pleasure to have you on, mate. I'm very grateful for you being here today to share some stories, the connections. I love in particular Bridgend. I just love our catchment. I just think there's so much talent here, and you've impacted so many people of generations after yours just from what you've done and created the path for people like myself to go down that league road, like Ben Evans and Reese Evans back in the day at Warrington. Yeah, you know, we followed the path of people like you. So yeah. I'm very grateful for that, John.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, mate.
Cheers. Don't just talk it, walk it. Walk it only. Don't just talk it, walk it. Don't just talk it, walk it. Walk it on.
just talk it, walk it, walk it on.